For the week of February 19th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 356, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz, but I was in Nashville over the weekend.
You were in Nashville just to cut your record, right? Or just were you guesting on somebody else's record?
I was doing a little background vocals, sweetening up the mix.
Okay, well, I think you've definitely looked up a few music industry terms, some recording terms.
That's right, I have, because I'm staying on top of the music industry, unlike apparently the book and film industry.
Well, certainly, I mean, you do try to stay on top of the book and film industry, but sometimes things move so fast that even you, Michael, can't keep up. In fact, last week you mentioned a book. Do you remember the book you were talking about?
Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders.
Right. And you said, look, you know, sometimes you just have to go with the book of the moment as your pick over at Bookfilter for the book of the week. And indeed, it was the book of the week over on Bookfilter. And lo and behold, it's in the New York Times. It's in, you know, the LA Times. It's literally, this book is everywhere.
Everybody's talking about it. And I talked about the inevitable possible film project and whether Spielberg would do it or Tim Burton. And now you make me look like a fool because you're like, guess what, dude?
Yeah, that's right. The New York Times already turned it into a 12-minute movie or 11-minute movie. And it's a virtual reality movie. Literally, you don't have to watch it in virtual reality, but you can if you want to. If you have those little Google Cardboard glasses, you can stick your phone in there somehow and turn around and it's all in 3D. But if not, you can just watch it on your computer or on your iPad or your tablet, and you can, you know, zoom around and the different voices are coming out. It's kind of spooky, actually. They did a good job on this.
Well, you told me about it, and I just started to look at it, and my initial reaction is probably predictable and knee-jerk. I guess anything that brings attention to your website is good, and people create original content all the time for their websites, so why shouldn't the Times do it? But my thought was, why are they doing this? Why are they spending however much impressive amount of money it looks like they spent on this to create a short film about a book? It seems far from their mission.
Maybe, by the way, the publisher paid for this. Who knows? And they said, okay, we'll give you this money. You go make it, but we'll pay for it. Much like, and I thought this was very odd, the New
York, that's what I assume happened.
Yeah, the New York Times had an article about Alison Krauss in yesterday's arts section, in the Sunday arts section.
She has a new soap album out.
Right, and in the page before the big page-length interview of Alison Krauss is an ad for that album. And I thought, wow, that's, you know, maybe at least separate it by a week.
Well, this is the week the album comes out.
Then you can't do that. So yeah, I guess you can't. But yeah. It was like, you know, on opposite pages.
They have stories about movies the weekend they open up and there are ads in the paper for those movies. It's just can't be helped.
Yeah, no, I guess not.
There are 10,000 albums they didn't do a story on. And you say, yeah, but they didn't have ads in the paper. But it's a natural crossover audience. Anyway, it just seems like a lot of money for something that seems a little weird. They do create original content like fiction and they serialize novels. It just struck me. And now we spent 10 minutes talking about it.
Yeah, I don't know why we spent. Here we were talking before the show that this was going to be the one episode that lasted under an hour. And now we have clearly blown that practice.
Well, what will we be talking about when the episode actually begins?
Well, when it actually begins, if it were to begin right now, we would be talking this week on Showbiz Sandbox about gearing up for next week's Oscar ceremony by going over some of the top prizes handed out by the Writers Guild, as well as the winners of the Berlin Film Festival, which ended this past weekend. During our book filter segment, Michael, you're going to make your pitch for a documentary film about political protests. And yes, I'm sure it will involve a book, or maybe 30 or 40 of them, because, you know, why limit it to just one? On Inside Baseball, we'll look at why a commissioner from the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, claims that high-speed internet is not really a necessity and that 4K streaming video is at least a decade off. Is he right? Spoiler alert, he's not, and we'll explain why. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the rest of the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. We're looking at box office around the world. Last weekend, we had about four new movies that opened up and looked like they had great success. Maybe even a fifth, but now turns out that's not true. So four films launched, all hits. This week, no new hits on the horizon. No new hits whatsoever. But the number one movie around the world, according to ComScore, which we link to in our show notes, and we also pull info from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, you name it, That number one movie is 50 Shades Darker, $65 million over the weekend, $275 million worldwide. And it looks like this second film, which opened up a little bit lower but had a pretty darn good hold in North America, it looks like it may pretty much match the original. And that will be a big success for two movies with really bad reviews.
I mean, horrible reviews, just not good reviews.
Yeah. At number two around the world is a movie with good reviews. It's the Lego Batman movie, the second in what is clearly a franchise, $55 million worldwide, $170 million and counting. At number three is The Great Wall, the Zhang Yimou film that has opened up in North America. Did not garner a lot of attention. You can say that $18 million over the weekend came strictly from the name of Matt Damon, but it grossed $37 million worldwide, and it's at $260 million in counting, which is not great since the movie cost $150 million, but maybe there are some big territories left. Right now, it's playing in 47 of them.
Well, you know, it opened in China quite a while ago, and it did great.
Well, good. It matched its budget.
Right. It did not garner good reviews, so it almost seemed as if the headline writers for the week after this film opened in the U.S. had been planning this for the moment that they heard that the film might not be any good. So they say, "The Great Wall crumbles at the box office."
Of course.
Yeah. I mean, by the way, that was just one of many, Great Wall falls or whatever.
Make their job easy. They love you for it. And number four is La La Land, the Oscar hopeful, which will win Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Actress. $36 million over the weekend, $340 million worldwide. And number five, John Wick Chapter 2, like he's a novel, $32 million. I bet John Wick hasn't even read a novel. He looks like he's too busy shooting people in the head to read a novel. $32 million over the weekend, $90 million worldwide.
But I'll tell you this, if John Wick were reading a novel and he lost his novel or you stole it from him, oh boy, I pity you.
And number six is XXX, The Return of Xander Cage, $30 million over the weekend, $308 million worldwide, making that a solid success story for perhaps what is the revitalization of a modest franchise.
Well, and we're talking about Xander Cage here. There was a big article in the LA Times about how this film was marketed in China and how it was marketed they targeted their marketing and they did it via digital to very specific audiences, and it really, really worked. It made a mint in China.
It worked because of that marketing. I mean, we know it made a mint. It had a big international cast. Vin Diesel's a big star. His movies have done well there. Do we know that marketing in particular paid off, or is it just the sort of thing, we did it and the movie worked, so we think maybe that's why?
I think it's the last thing that you said. Whatever the choices were, it was the last one where it's like, we did this. It's different than what we did in the U.S. And guess what? In China, it played better than in the U.S. And that's where we did this type of marketing. So maybe the two, there's a corollary there, cause and effect.
I think you have to target your audience in China because otherwise you're advertising to a billion people.
Right.
And number seven is Sing, the animated American Idol type movie. Our friend Aaron Rich saw this movie and said it was good.
What?
He said he liked it.
That shocks anybody who knows Aaron Rich, who likes and watches so many movies, and many of them movies that we'll never see, in fact, because they are, I don't want to say they're obscure, but they're not widely distributed.
He likes art films and international movies.
As do myself, and I'm sure you too, Michael. I don't want to speak for you, but for him to like Sing, I'm a little shocked.
He said, well, they probably blew getting more attention by opening it towards the rush at the end of the year. Maybe if they positioned it better, they might have even gotten more attention. But it certainly made money, $19 million over the weekend, $530 million worldwide. So that's a big success story.
Indeed, actually, in Argentina and Brazil, that film specifically, that and Moana, Sing and Moana, are the two films that helped both in Argentina and Brazil in the month of January ticket sales increase at the box office.
Okay. You mean compared to 1 year earlier?
Compared to 1 year earlier, and frankly, compared to December.
Oh, wow. And number eight is the M. Night Shyamalan horror flick Split, $15 million over the weekend, $190 million worldwide. So it's now going to reach, 20 times its reported budget of $10 million. And it's still chugging along. And number nine is another Oscar hopeful Hidden Figures. I think they're going to end up disappointed on the big night, but they are very happy with their $14 million takeover the weekend and $160 million worldwide, which points out something that you'll notice. All nine Best Picture nominees are adult-driven box office hits. They're movies made for adults, for adults, by adults, about adult things. You know, people say they don't make movies for adults anymore. Well, they do. And all nine of them made money, with the possible exception of Hell or High Water, which is a little bit on the bubble. All the other eight are strong, solid box office hits. They're modest, mostly. You're talking a couple hundred million for the really big ones, like Hidden Figures and La La Land, and that's it. But they've all made money. And well, so it can be done, and you can get Oscar glory, and each one of those guys is a winner critically and commercially.
Now, do you have like a spy thing or software on my computer? Because I'm actually writing a piece for Celluloid Junkie on that very subject, thanks to Movio and the AARP, the Association, the American Association of Retired People, I believe is the full name.
I just joined.
And I'm right behind
you. You can join at 50, and I've been 50, but I joined because I thought they were not speaking up enough about Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security. I was annoyed with them when they agreed to the grand bargain with Obama to slash benefits, which was unnecessary, and I thought they should have been taking a different tactic, and I was angry and pushing them to speak out explicitly against the block grants, and by God, January 31st, that's exactly what they did. So join the AARP if you want to have your voice heard, because they're one of the most effective lobbyist groups in the country.
Well,
and they have a pretty good magazine that reaches out and interviews Bob Dylan and does some good entertainment stuff.
And they have this annual award ceremony, Movies for Grownups. And this year they teamed up with Movio, which is a data analytics company for movies, obviously. And they kind of looked at how the movies nominated for Best Picture were being watched by both males and females, and who was watching them, and the average age being much, much higher, as you say, Michael, adults, over 50, and what that was like before and after the nominations.
Yeah, my mom and her friends just went to see La La Land over the, like, 5-6 days ago. Four women, two liked it, two didn't.
Yeah, it's really slowly kind of dividing people, and I don't understand why, but...
Because it's not that good.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have some issues with it as well, but hey, you know what? It's enjoyable. I liked it. You hated it. You know.
I didn't hate it, but I did not like it. I wish I liked it more, that's for darn sure. And number 10 is a movie most people didn't like. It's Ice Cube's Fist Fight. $12 million on its opening weekend. It costs maybe $25 million to make, and Ice Cube is a pretty solid performer. You can really take your money to the bank if you invest in his films. He makes the right movies for the right dollar amount, and they're almost always profitable. This one may not be. I doubt it's going to have good legs, but we'll see. And number 11 is A Cure for Wellness, another movie that opened on this weekend and did not do well. It's sort of a sci-fi dystopian film, $8 million on its opening weekend in 37 territories. I assume most of the others were not big territories, but not a good opening for that film. Bad reviews, bad box office, is a bad day at the bank. And number 12 is Lion, the Weinstein Oscar hopeful, $8 million over the weekend, just about $80 million worldwide. Going down, trying to look for some new movies, there's Recep Ivedik. I should have looked up how to spell this. I apologize to everyone involved. It's Recep Ivedik, number 5. It's a Turkish comedy starring this big oaf named Recep, and he's taking his team to the Junior Olympics, I believe, and hijinks ensue. The character is played by Sahan Gökbakar. He created the character for a TV show on Turkish television. It was a show that sort of was a sketch comedy show that played off the news, and somehow it came up with this big oafish guy who's sort of good-natured and good-hearted from what I could see from the trailers. The first movie cost $500,000 to make. I can't find any information on any of the others, but I'm assuming they're not radically more expensive. And this one opened to $7 million on its opening weekend. So I'm assuming that's a pretty darn good opening for Recep Ivedik number 5.
Well, and here's how you pronounce that.
Recep Ivedik 5.
Good God, was I wrong. I should have just spelled it. Moving on quickly, another new movie is Alibi.com. It's a wacky French comedy, co-written, directed, and starring Philippe Lachaud. He did Babysitter and Babysitter 2. I think he got his start in like reality TV in France. It opened to $6.5 million. Isn't this the movie that I had the budget on? That was a Red Dingu. So that movie, I don't know the budget on that either. If you do know the budget of that Turkish comedy or this French comedy, let us know.
Yeah, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's DIRT@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, and we do respond to messages left there for us, like Raul Buril did this past week. At Showbiz Sandbox is our handle. Or you can look us up on Facebook, where our page can be found under Showbiz Sandbox.
There's a new movie in Korea. It's called Retrial, or actually New Trial, I think is a better translation. And again, like if you do contact us, I'm still not clear whether it's preferred to say Korean or South Korean. I'm not sure what the politics or the implications are by doing that. But it's a drama based on a true story of a teenager who was falsely accused of killing a cabbie, and he spends 10 years in prison until a crusading lawyer fights for a new trial. It sounds somewhat similar, but a little more sober than the fun, offbeat movie called Fabricated City that came out last week that we said would make a really good Hollywood remake because that kid was a gamer. And so he had to go in the online and offline world to sort of, you know, regain his freedom. But, you know, it opened to $6 million over the weekend. Dog's Purpose is doing fine. The movie that opened rather controversially has now tripled its budget. It's going to do just okay. And again, more and more movies, the budgets are popping up in the second or third weekend of their opening. So it's nice to know people are out there paying attention to these movies and adding in budgets on Wikipedia and elsewhere. Ray Dingu is a French comedy about mismatched cops. It's written, directed, and starring Danny Boone. And the budget popped up. It made $4 million over the weekend. It's made $28 million total. And the budget on Wikipedia said it was $32 million. And I thought, dear God, that seems like a lot of money for a French comedy. And I looked back on some other movies of Danny Boone, and a lot of them seem to be in the mid-20s to $30 million range. So it's not an unusual claim. There was no credit. There was no link backing up this claim that it was a $32 million budget. But you look at his earlier movies, and that seems to be sort of where he was in for most of the movies that he was in charge of. And I'm just wondering why that big a budget for a movie that's maybe only going to play in the French territories. It seems like too much.
Yeah, well, 30-some-odd million dollars, that's a lot of money for that type of film, I agree.
And it was not unusual at all. 22, 25, 30 million. I saw three or four or five movies of his all in the mid-20s to 30s range. So I'm a little surprised. I can't imagine you expect to make $90 million in France alone on a comedy. That's not a reasonable expectation, I don't think. So I'm not sure what's going on. Maybe they're getting a tax write-off. I don't know what's going on there. And then finally, one more movie to talk about that looks a little new. It's called Rock and Roll. And it's an Indian musical, or I might call it a Bollywood musical, but it's made in the language of Malayalam. That's found in southern India. And so I believe... I think Bollywood is sort of all embracing. Do people in southern India make movies in Malayalam consider themselves not Bollywood, but a separate industry? I hope we're being respectful. But it's the story of a famous composer. He falls in love with a backup singer, and he's trying to woo her, and he writes a song to show her how much he loves her, and she's about to get married to another man. I'm sure it all ends up well. But it's written and directed by Ranjith Balakrishnan. Ranjith seems to be the name he goes by. He's just Ranjith, like Cher, but his full name is Ranjith Balakrishnan, and this is his movie, and it looks interesting, and I'm going to call it a Bollywood musical until someone tells me I'm wrong. It opened to $3.6 million.
You know, I hesitate to speak on this because I know that there are areas in India where the local area says you need to release films in a specific language, and I probably shouldn't. If I had known we were going to discuss this, I would have looked it up. But there are a few languages that are underrepresented in those areas, and they're trying to beef them up. And I want to say Malayalam is one of them, but I could be wrong.
Well, it's one of the 20 plus official languages recognized, and looking it up and trying to figure out what was going on, it turns out that their written version of the language kind of is pretty all embracing and can sort of recreate the languages of almost every other language spoken in India. So it's I get the sense that's an all-inclusive written language and that it's pretty broadly inclusive as well. Not that that many people speak it, but just that it is a language that encompasses or overlaps on a number of other ones. But of course, I'm speaking out of very little knowledge and a lot of ignorance. We're doing our best.
Kind of
we're
like our show.
We're tracking the film box office all over the world, and we're trying to figure out what's going on in all these countries.
Yeah, and I actually did a story last week for Celluloid Junkie, another little shameless plug there, on Indonesia and its film market.
And how's it doing?
Well, you know, for years, it was, you know, kind of, well, Suharto was in charge for 30 years, and there was a monopoly allowed in the country where only one company who, you know, just so happened that the person who started the company and founded the company and ran the company was related to its autocratic leader. Only one company could distribute any imported movie or any movie in the country, and could own and operate movie theaters as well. So, you know, there was no outside investment in that, you know, creative industry allowed. So last year in 2016, it was opened up by its current leader and elected leader, I should say. And now, so all of these movie theater chains are flooding in there. 20th Century Fox is going to be, or I should say Fox International Productions is making a film in the territory. So it's definitely on the rise.
All right. We can't even figure out what's going on in Hollywood. It seemed like Brad Grey was doing just fine at Viacom and Paramount, but now apparently he's out.
Well, I mean, for the last couple of months, probably the last half year, there's been some question, will he survive? Will Brad Grey, the CEO of Paramount Pictures, survive this kind of changing guard at Viacom? And the answer is probably not.
The answer is definitely not. If they're printing in the papers that they're having talks about departuring, he's departing.
Departuring? Okay.
Departuring. Yeah. I made it up.
Okay. Well, hey, you know what? That's why you tune in here, because we make up our own language. Forget about Malayalam. We have our own language.
But he, you know, it's 3 years of bad performance at the box office. You know, that's not, it's not difficult to understand. It's not because there was a change in the guard and they want to put the, it's like, you're not making good movies that are making money, and there's not a lot of good movies on the horizon. So you're out.
Well, and you know, they haven't had a chairman for the Paramount Picture Group for some time, and so therefore, you know, they really haven't made any big moves in the film division. What can you do? I mean, Adam Goodman, I think he was let go. I don't even know when he was let go from Paramount. I want to say it was the beginning of 2015, but I mean, he
what was his role?
He was the head of Paramount Pictures. He was the one that said, yes, make that movie, don't make that movie. I mean, he...
Doesn't Brad Grey have green light now? And that's the thing that they're saying, you can't have green light anymore. And he's like, I'm out of here.
Yeah. Basically, all of these companies now are going to kind of a green light by committee. And you know how that always works out. Just look at the 1960s to find out.
Does Disney do that?
Disney, I believe it does. Yeah. I mean, Alan Horn has a, you know... major
well,
sway
they're
there.
Doing fine. You say it doesn't work, you say it always ends up with crappy movies, or what do you mean?
Well, I think that you wind up with compromised movies. Yes. I mean, Disney happens to have a number of really good properties, so that helps. Okay.
Well, they're not making good movies, they're just making popular, successful movies.
Correct. There you go.
All right. Well, some movies win awards and some don't. We had the WGA Awards last night. Moonlight beat out La La Land and Manchester by the Sea, and Arrival beat out Hidden Figures. Does that mean anything for the Oscars? Who knows?
Well, I do think that Moonlight will win Best Adapted Screenplay at the Oscars. I think that...
I believe that's original screenplay, isn't it?
I don't know, actually.
Oh, no, it is. It is. No, it's... no, that's original.
Are you sure about that?
It is, because Arrival is based on a short story, and Fences is based on a play, and Hidden Figures is based on a book. And I know Manchester by the Sea is original, and I know La La Land is original, and I know Moonlight is inspired by an unproduced play and the life of the director, but I believe it's considered an original screenplay.
Huh, okay. Well, I don't know why I thought that was going to... Maybe...
maybe you're racist.
No, what? That has nothing to do with... Best Adapted Screenplay. Okay, so we have Arrival, okay. We have Moonlight. And the Academy moved two scripts, Moonlight and Loving, from original to adapted. Technically, the play, Barry Jenkins.
So the WGA classified it differently.
Yes, exactly.
So Moonlight will win Best Adapted Screenplay.
Yes, correct.
Yes. All right. And TV, I got to watch the TV shows The Americans and Atlanta. I did start watching Legion, which I liked quite a lot.
Well, okay. So Americans, I watched the first half season of that, and I just... You know, the TiVo erased the other half of the season, but boy, I was really into it then, and everybody I know who's watched it says it's amazing. So I really do have to catch up on like 5 years worth of episodes now.
That's okay. You can binge watch, and you'll know there's an ending coming, so you'll be all right.
And I can't binge watch Atlanta, at least not yet. I can't find it anywhere. I want to watch it because everybody's loving it, and I don't have it anywhere, and it's not on any of the services yet.
Well, that's the WGA Awards, and of course the Oscars are on Sunday. And one category that seems to be tightening up is Best Actor a little bit, perhaps. Do we just assume Casey Affleck has won most of them, but Denzel just won something? Well, he won the BAFTA, and yeah. I think he won something else. That doesn't really indicate a tightening up of the race, or does it? Some people say, oh, Casey Affleck, you know, the blowback of some of the uglier incidents from earlier in his career and the civil lawsuit against him for sexual harassment and all that are catching up with him.
Yeah, and I think that certainly the press likes to write about stuff like that, and they certainly have been over the last 2 months. And so maybe it is catching up with him at a, you know, an unfortunate time for him, because I do believe that this year he really did a phenomenal job in Manchester by the Sea and probably does deserve to win.
It would be my vote, putting aside his personal life. But I don't know if you want to say the press loves to write about it or whether they should write about it. You know, you're acting like, yay, he's in sexual harassment charges. Maybe they're like, well, we have to write about it. Maybe they'd be happy to write he has a happy marriage and didn't, you know, and didn't have any civil lawsuits against him. That wouldn't hurt him.
Yeah, no. And look, I'm not a big fan of him as a person, Casey Affleck, having met him and interviewed him and worked with him a couple of times. Not a big fan of him as a person. This particular role, he did a very good job.
I was just pointing to your comments about the media.
Oh,
as okay. If they are gleeful over reporting sexual harassment charges.
No. It's just that between Nate Parker and Casey Affleck, they had this, you know, well, why is one person being treated differently than, you know, why is Casey Affleck being lauded and Nate Parker, who did The Birth of a Nation and was, you know, acquitted of sexual assault in the 90s, why is he not up for more awards? And the reality is, one movie worked, one movie didn't. There's your answer.
And we had Oscar talk last week about UTA hosting a refugee rally instead of a party. And I wondered blithely, well, gee, do they have any clients competing for Oscars? Do they have any sort of dog in that fight? And it turns out they do. To their credit, they did this refugee rally because of a client of theirs, Iranian director Asghar Farhadi, who symbolically said, I will not attend even if I'm able to get a waiver or the ban is dropped, in solidarity with the other people who can't. And UTA said, hey, let's act on this. Rather than having a party, let's do something. And this is what they did. So full credit to them.
Well, and in London, they're going to be showing The Salesman in Trafalgar Square the night the Oscars are shown. So while it'll be ahead of time, since, you know, London is, you know, 8 hours ahead of Los Angeles, but still, it's going to be shown. They're showing this, I guess, whether it's a coincidence or not, I don't know. There is a lot of talk about how Asghar Farhadi will now win for The Salesman, Best Foreign Language Feature, even though everybody believes Tony Erdman is the better film.
I don't know that.
Well,
I don't agree with that.
Well, I'm pointing out what the
media don't think there's a clear, oh, everybody know. No, I don't agree with that.
Okay, well, I certainly...
I've seen great reviews for The Salesman. Okay. I know you like Tony Erdman more, but I've seen great reviews for both movies.
Yes, and I was surprised that a number of the stories I've read that were predicting the Oscars actually went so far as to say, well, X film should win, though Asghar Farhadi will wind up walking away with it. And Tony, you know, I thought, yes, I like Tony Erdman, but did everybody? And more of the stories I read are saying Tony Erdman should win, but Asghar Farhadi will win.
All right. Well, in Berlin, we know who won as well, don't we? It's the Hungarian love story On Body and Soul won the Golden Bear at the Berlin Film Festival.
Yes, I love what The Hollywood Reporter had to say about this. They said it was the surprise winner of the Golden Bear for best film at this year's festival. And this is what they said. For Anyeti, this is the director of this film, the award's attention is the fulfillment of the promise shown with her debut. Now, when I got to that part of the sentence, I thought, well, she must have directed something recently. But they were referring to My 20th Century, which won the Cannes Camera d'Or Prize for Best First Feature back in 1989. So when they said it's the fulfillment of the promise shown, it's like, yeah, 30 years ago.
So, okay. Well, I miss your point.
I guess as I read it, I thought the way they were writing the sentence, it made it seem like, oh, well, yeah, she won this prize like a week or two ago or like, you know, a year or two ago. And no, it was, you know, 30 years ago.
Well, aren't you just an impatient teenager?
Speaking of impatient, I love this next part. Aki Kaurismäki. Now, Michael, you know Aki Kaurismäki, right?
Aki Kaurismäki, yes, is a lovely director.
Finnish director. I love his movies, but he's a bit of a personality, to say the least, right? Have you ever been to one of his press conferences?
No, I don't really know anything about him.
Oh, my God. So he's a Finnish director, okay? And he is kind of eccentric. And everybody always says, look, he is a raging alcoholic. I don't know whether that's true, but he shows up for his press conferences in what appears to be a drunken state. And they're phenomenal press conferences because he's just so funny and he's just completely insane at his press conference. I love going to them. But he won the Silver Bear for Best Director for his film The Other Side of Hope, which is a heartwarming tale of a Syrian refugee who travels to Finland to seek asylum. And the Hollywood Reporter said a nonplussed Karasmaki didn't even make it to the stage but accepted his trophy from his seat. That is such a Karasmaki move.
Well, looking up at the winner, the Hungarian filmmaker Inyedi's career, she had that breakthrough with her first film, My 20th Century, which won the Camera d'Or. Then she had a few more movies in the next few years, right up to 1999. She made four more movies, and then nothing for many, many years. As a female director, she may have found it hard to get a movie made. She made two shorts. Then she latched onto a hit TV series called Terapia. And on the wave of that, she was able to get back and make a feature film on Body and Soul. And now she's triumphed. So it's only her sixth film in 30 years, perhaps because the opportunities open to her weren't as great as they might be for someone else.
Yeah, I mean, I was only joking around about the way the sentence was constructed. I really thought, like, oh, well, she must have won this award that I overlooked just, you know, 2 years ago. No, it was, you know, about 25 years ago.
But Brad Grey is having a bad time at Paramount, and Jack Ma's Alibaba Pictures is not having a good time either, are they?
No, and actually what I'm sure Jack Ma would say is, nope, this is all in the grand plan. You know, we plan to lose $140 million with Alibaba Pictures this past year, 2016.
And that's right, and I plan to still be in student loan debt when I'm in my 50s.
Yeah, well, actually, you probably should not have planned that. That's bad planning, FYI.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
I would... You may need Jack Ma to help you out a little.
So what's going on at Alibaba?
Well, okay, so they lost 140, or conceivably may have lost $140 million. The company is warning the Hong Kong Stock Exchange to expect major losses for 2016. But, and I'm...
Well, I would believe them, wouldn't you?
Yes.
They say, hey, just telling you, we may have big losses. I'm going to go on a limb and say, I'll bet they're right.
Yeah, in the financial industry, they call that guidance, okay? And they're saying that the reason this occurred is because of their mobile ticketing service, and I know I'm about to butcher this, Tai Piao Piao, which...
Well, Dao, surely, Dao.
Dao Piao Piao, which is this is... I'm sure I just butchered that. But in any case, it's a mobile ticketing app. There is a mobile ticketing war going on right now in China for market share, and there's all these different companies competing to gain the most market share. And there's been some discussion, and we've talked about it here, as to whether all of these apps, which are offering discounted tickets, okay, so they'll go out and buy all the tickets and then give them to you, Michael, the consumer, at a much reduced rate. So this is how you have all of these films playing out in theaters to empty theaters, because the mobile ticketing apps have purchased the tickets and then couldn't sell them on to consumers at a reduced rate. There's been some talk about it kind of boosting up and artificially inflating the Chinese box office, something that we saw at the latter part of 2016 when these mobile ticketing apps began to stop doing this.
I would go to the movies more if I could get a ticket legally for $4. Sure.
Exactly. So more than 70% of movie tickets sold in China are sold via mobile ticketing as compared to 20% here in the United States and elsewhere. So that's really why Alibaba
Pictures, bleeding money.
They're bleeding money, yeah. So we'll see what happens. Obviously, they lost money this year. I think they've probably stopped subsidizing as strongly and as heavily as they have in the past, so that kind of blood flow, as you say, might end.
It looks like, looking up online, that it is Dao Piao Piao, so that's pretty good.
Okay. But that's numbers for Alibaba Pictures. I highlighted this story, Michael, from the New York Times about how, you know, basically television still can drive a lot of music sales.
Well, not music sales.
Yes, you're right.
That's right. What happens is somebody goes on Jon Stewart and they say, oh, their book jumped 472% from 1 week earlier. It's like, yeah, they went from 4 books to 9 books. Big deal. So, you know, when they talk about percentage leaps up the charts of iTunes or stuff like that, ignore it. You know, when they tell you specific sales units, then you can talk something. So this story is talking about television is still a great platform to promote an artist. Right.
The Grammys had 26 million viewers. The Super Bowl had 117 million viewers the week before. So then they looked at Lady Gaga's sales and streaming and, you know, million reasons. That one song that she sang from her new album, Joanne, it went all the way to number four on Billboard's Hot 100. It was never even on. Well, I guess maybe it was like at 52 last year, but it was nowhere near the charts.
And right. And that's an example of something that's meaningless, because if people stream it, okay, she'll jump up the charts in a week and then maybe go back down the following week. They do say that they cut the cost of the song in half practically and sold 150,000 downloads. So right. That's something. More importantly, I think, is when they say, hey, it promotes her, gets her music streamed and listened to, and then the next day she puts on her ticket sales for her tour. That to me is where you're making a useful comment. You're saying, hey, you're still reaching a lot of people, and the only way to see Lady Gaga live is to go see her live. So, you know, you may not buy the album. You may just stream the song rather than buying it. But if you want to go see her in concert, you got to buy a ticket. So that as a platform to raise her visibility and make people say, yeah, I want to see her in concert, which is where she makes most of her money. That is where it does make sense. And TV is powerful.
Right. And you're trying to create lifelong fans, not just fans of one song or one album. You're trying to look, 100 million people watching. Let's say you get 5% of them to go out and stream or buy something. That's 5 million. And let's say out of that, you get 5% of that, you get 50,000 to 100,000 people who become lifelong fans. That's pretty good. That's what you're looking for. You're looking for those fans that will buy the next album or come and see you on tour. That's where the money is, as you've said. What I found interesting about this article, Michael, and I thought you'd find it interesting too, is that they talked about Sturgill Simpson, an artist, a country singer that I know you like. His song All Around You had sold 20 downloads total. Okay, in the day before the awards show, the day before the Grammys, okay?
Which is not surprising, because he's not a hot-selling artist of any nature. Certainly not a singles artist or not, you know, he's a modestly selling, you know, act.
But to get that kind of like precise, 20 downloads. I mean, normally you hear, yeah, it wasn't selling and now it's selling
more.
And then he performs on the Grammys, and that day he sells 2,200 downloads. Now, I would think that 2,200, that's still really low, right?
That's pathetic. Yeah, right. It's very low.
Then you read about Bruno Mars, right? That he sang this song, That's What I Like. He had track sales jump from 5,000 to 22,800. Again, I would say, okay, well, okay, 22,800, that's a lot. But
no, that's nothing.
I would still think that he would be selling way more than that.
Well, but that's like we said the previous week, looking at the Grammys, how there has been a dramatic fall off in sales for everybody across the board. Big major artists, you know, U2, Bruno Mars, you name it, all these big name acts, you can look in the past decade and see how Grammy albums were all selling 3, 5, 8, 10, 12, 15 million copies. And nowadays, you're lucky if they go gold. You know, I mean, you look at, Sturgill Simpson is not a good example, because he's never even gone gold his entire career. But you look at U2 and Bruno Mars and all these people, their album sales have collapsed. The only people who are selling albums are Adele, Taylor, maybe. You know, she had the 35 million. This one did 20. If the next one does 10, then you're just talking momentum from a big blockbuster hit. The next album does half as good, and the next album may do half as good again. So that may not even hold up. But Taylor Swift, maybe Adele, and maybe Ed Sheeran. I feel like he's going to sell some albums. But you look at Bruno Mars, 6 million copies for his world first album, 6 million copies for his second album. His third album hasn't even gone gold in the U.S. yet.
Wow.
Nothing. Nothing. It's just, you know, he's gone from 2.5 million copies in the U.S. to 200,000 copies in the U.S. It's just across the board. People do not buy. They don't feel the need to own music anymore. It's a whole different world.
Well, I know that in the U.K. and in Europe, we often get details and sales figures for books, whereas here in the U.S. we don't. And frankly, you know, it's very frustrating when you hear, oh, you know, Nora Roberts or whoever is, you know, on the bestseller list. That could be like five books. You never really know, which is my way of bringing us to our book filter segment, which, by the way, book filter is a book lover's best friend. Okay, Michael, each week you pick one book that you've selected with our listeners in mind. Sometimes it's a book that we should be reading. Sometimes it's a book that you think would make a great adapted television show or movie. What book have you selected for us this week?
That's right. If you go to our website, you'll find four other books in our show notes. One is a business book about the founder of Zappos. One is another Anglophilic book about the summer before World War I, which I found quite charming. One is about a woman riding on a motorbike across Iran, and a journalist, which is really fun. And one is the finale of a fantasy trilogy, which somebody maybe should pick up. But I wanted to focus on this book called Direct Action, and it's by L.A. Kaufman. And I somehow had the idea it was going to be like a how-to book. I thought maybe I'm going to learn how to protest at rallies. It turns out it's a history of direct action activism. And obviously the roots go way back to the civil rights and probably to the suffragette movement and before that. But it begins in 1971 with the May Day movement, which I'd heard about vaguely but forgotten. It was a big movement to protest the war. It took place the day after my birthday on May 3rd, 1971. And thousands of activists planned to shut down DC. They said, if we can't stop the war, we'll stop the government. And they created this elaborate action to do that. And the government found out about it, and because it was so well planned. And they pretty much arrested everybody right away at the beginning of the day. But this author, L.A. Kaufman, says, you know what? It was seen as a failure at the time. But in fact, it rattled the government quite a bit. And it inspired a lot of people to do similar direct action in the future. And so it begins with that action. It goes to environmental movement like Earth First. Of course, it goes up to ACT UP, which is a really a game changer in terms of direct action, right up to Occupy Wall Street and Black Lives Matter today. Now, the book is a little scholarly. It's not a narrative. It doesn't tell stories in terms of like a grippy narrative about people and what happened to them in all those days. But it is very interesting how certain elements sprung up and fed one another, how lesbians were everywhere. They always helped everybody. Any movement, the lesbians are there helping you. You want them on your side, trust me. But groups would be in one group and then go to another group and share their ideas of organizing. And if you're wondering from Occupy Wall Street why they were doing all these goofy, weird things like they have consensus and you raise your hand and you do this and everybody, yeah, it springs up from this movement and how it spread from feminist socialist movements all throughout all these different areas and how they organized and evolved and planned their actions. It has roots in all these stories from the 70s and earlier.
Well, so could you look at this? Could you look at that and kind of go backwards and say, okay, well, that's how those movements were created. There are seeds in there for how to do this in the future. So you said maybe it's not a how-to book directly, but maybe it is a how-to book if you kind of look at history and figure out how those movements were started and whether that practice could be applied to the modern day.
Exactly. So they don't spell out necessarily what it means to have the consensus or how it actually works, but they discuss the techniques and the ideas. I find the book interesting, but I also found the story, the narrative, fascinating of all these different movements in the U.S. Basically, that's what we're talking about. And all these splintered groups that seem to have nothing in common, but they have in common direct action. And so I thought it would be a great documentary film because they created all these events for the media. They want the media to cover them. They became incredibly media savvy. And so there's tons of footage from all these events and all these people from 1970 on to today. So there's a wealth of material out there. And you would be telling the story of direct action through all these different, you would be linking all these disparate causes. You'd be showing how they grew out of one another. And it'd be an exciting look at, you know, political activism in America. And I think it would make a really good documentary film.
Well, you know, I actually saw a good documentary film over the weekend called I Am Not Your Negro. This is the film.
I never thought you were.
Well, okay. You know, this was James Baldwin saying it, actually.
Okay.
And it's, I don't know whether it's nominated for an Academy Award. I feel like it is.
It is.
Okay. It's written by James Baldwin. And I thought, well, wait a second. How did he write a movie? He's dead. But it's based on his final unfinished book about Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, and Martin Luther King Jr. He knew all three of them during the civil rights movement. And it is specifically what you're talking about, Michael, how these different disparate movements, civil rights movements, and as you know, Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr., they had kind of differing opinions on how to go about, you know, gaining their civil rights.
They were finding more common ground as both lives were shut out too early.
That's right. And that's exactly what is pointed out. It's a fascinating work by somebody who is incredibly eloquent, and it's worth watching, if only because there are times, for instance, in which – Bobby Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, the attorney general, was talking about maybe one day, if you're quote unquote good, if you behave, there might even be a black president one day. And that was said in, you know, 1960, you know, really early in the 60s. And, you know, James Baldwin took affront to that, that, you know, of course it'll never happen because look at the way it was said. Look at the way that was presented. Of course it's not going to happen. As juxtaposed with, you know, Barack Obama walking down Pennsylvania Avenue during his first inauguration.
It's one of five nominees, including 13th by Ava DuVernay, OJ, Made in America, which I hope will win, Fire at Sea, I Am Not Your Negro, and Life Animated.
Now, Life Animated played at Sundance last year. It was one of those films where when you read the little blurb about what it's about, you're like, what, a guy who's autistic who finds, you know, solace and communicates through Disney film? I don't want to see that. And then, of course, look at what happens. Fire at Sea played in Berlin last year and won the Berlin Film Festival last year.
Yep, and Meryl Streep was the head of the jury.
Ah, okay. Well, now she's nominated for, you know, an Academy Award again.
So it turns out winning that award is a big deal.
Which award?
I'm just setting you up. There's a lob.
Is that the song?
I'm like, come on, let's go. We're big deal. What are we doing? You're still talking about all this. Come on, move it on.
Okay, Michael.
You're like, all right, we're not going to be under an hour, so we'll be under 2 hours. That's your new goal, apparently, this week. Oh, my God.
Well, if we were under an hour, it would be a big deal. Come on.
Anybody listening? Anybody?
Is this thing on? But it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, it's one I highlighted. I thought you'd appreciate this, Michael, because if you've flown on a commercial airline recently, all but the smallest airlines probably featured a tiny screen embedded into the seat in front of you. That little TV has gone from a novelty showing a few movies on a loop to a full-fledged entertainment system allowing you to play movies and TV shows on demand to, well, now it's considered old hat now. Yes, that screen will start disappearing soon in favor of your iPhone or laptop or tablet. Airlines will offer entertainment via streaming and get rid of the screens, starting with domestic flights. That will free up legroom underneath the seat in front of you and even allow them to put in more seats, because if it's a choice of giving you more comfort or adding in another row of seats, of course, they're going to choose more seats. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop, but I'm going to need a much longer power cord.
Yeah, well, that's the big thing is that right now all of these planes are putting in power outlets at every seat. They don't always work, though, and that's going to be a bit of an issue. And frankly, I like having the screen in front of me. I don't want to have to hold my own device the whole time, and it's kind of a big pain in the neck. Why would I want that?
Take your laptop out or your phone out. Yeah, I mean, I've never done that, but I guess. But yeah, it seems a solution in search of a problem, I guess. I guess everybody wants to stream, and they're demanding Wi-Fi, and so they're not even bothering with the entertainment system. So they're saying, well, why have that space? More leg room. Get rid of that. Add another row of seats, and if you want to stream something, we'll let you do that too.
Yeah, and guess what? You're not getting more legroom because they will just put in more seats. That's really...
Well, yes, they will, but the under the seat, there is a battery pack for the screen, and that allows a little more room and comfort for your seat and your bag underneath your seat as well. It makes it less crowded.
And you know what else it does? It allows these airlines to thin out their IT department to handle all of these electronics.
Well, I think the IT will... streaming will be complicated too. I don't know that it's a big job loss.
The tearful Rachel Lindsay has been a standout in the current run of ABC's dating show, The Bachelor. And now she's going to get her own run at Love thanks to becoming the network's first black bachelorette. It's no coincidence that the current head of ABC Entertainment is Channing Dungey, the network's first African-American woman to run any network entertainment division, frankly. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess it's a big whoop in the scheme of things, but, you know, it's about time. And it was kind of this self-perpetuating problem because they always picked the new bachelorette from the batch of women vying for the bachelor. And then when there was a bachelorette, they chose the next bachelor from the batch of guys vying to be the bachelor, you know, her man. So they kept, if you had 12 white people, you were only going to have 12 white people to choose from. And so they had to get diversity in those people vying for the attention of the star before they could start to have diversity in their picks. Long time coming. She looks like she'll be entertaining. So finally they've done it, and that's good.
Apparently not happy with the fake political stories promoted on the Fox News channel, the studio's marketing department came up with a great way to promote its new movie, A Cure for Wellness. The film is set in a fictitious spa in the Alps. So Fox placed a fake story online claiming Trump and Putin met at a spa in the Alps before Trump's election. The story made appearances on actual fake news websites, which is starting to make our heads hurt, actually, all of this. It's like worse than Inception. So it's fake news on a fake news website that was written fakely for a fake. Okay. Well, when criticized, Fox said basically, get over it. Then eventually they admitted, yeah, that was probably pretty dumb. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, it's just big stupidity. Oh, my God. Who could think that was a good idea?
Especially given that you own Fox News. Okay, which there's already, some question as to the veracity of some of your news stories. And now you go and do this.
No, it's just you run a news organization that's very profitable for you. You don't want to associate yourself with planting fake news stories. That's just not a good idea.
Now, this next story actually brings back the old excuse. I just read it for the articles. 1 year after Playboy banished nudity from its magazines in the hope of attracting more mainstream advertisers, the fabled Naughty Men's magazine has brought it back. They're still avoiding full frontal nudity, but breasts and bums are back in fashion, just as they are in primetime TV, cable, movies, and half the websites bookmarked on my browser. Hey, wait a second, I should read these before I read them. Anyway, founder Hugh Hefner's son was pretty succinct in explaining why Playboy is disrobing once again. Quote, "I'll be the first to admit the way in which the magazine portrayed nudity was dated, but removing it entirely was a mistake," Cooper Hefner tweeted Monday. "Nudity was never the problem because nudity isn't a problem. Today we're taking our identity back and rediscovering who we are." Hefner had opposed the ban from the start, and the new issue is headlined, "Nude is Normal." Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, you took my joke away.
What was that?
My joke was, now I can start reading it for the articles again.
Oh, okay.
Classy erotica should have always been their sweet spot. They became like out tawdriness of Penthouse and all the others. They went tawdrier, and they should have said, hey, we want sexy erotic stuff rather than here's my vagina. So if they were going to have a sweet spot and compete with all the online websites that are out there, that should have been it. But the real news is, again, we're talking about the March, April issue because they're down to 6 issues a year, and I'm surprised they're still around.
Apple finally revealed 2 of the original shows that will be made available to subscribers of Apple Music. The first is a shark tank for apps called Planet of the Apps with judges Gwyneth Paltrow, you know, the big Silicon Valley wonderkind, Gwyneth Paltrow.
Hey, will I make fun of her? I'm kidding. Why do you want to make fun of Gwyneth Paltrow? I have no desire to praise or damn Gwyneth Paltrow. Leave her alone.
Will I am? Can we, you know, praise or damn Will I Am? No. Jessica Alba and entrepreneur Gary Vaynerchuk deciding if the apps are worthy of their time. The other is, of course, a spinoff of Carpool Karaoke, mostly without James Corden as host. Apple doesn't plan on adding in commercials anytime soon, but other than that, Apple was pretty vague about the whole deal. The shows will launch in the spring along with the Dr. Dre series Vital Signs at some point soon. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. I mean, call us when you have a hit, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
But this is what I love. Apple's Eddie Q said of Planet of the Apps, "This is a show that's unlike anything that we see out there." Except, of course, for Shark Tank, The Voice, and all the other shows that it's exactly like. I mean, for God's sakes, why say something that stupid? And then this is the worst metaphor of the week I've heard. Which show is it? Oh, it's the app show. Again, executive producer Ben Silverman told the audience at this event that it will also have a standalone app, duh, with bonus clips and more information. He described this as like a rubber band. Quote, "You can watch a show and press pause and go as deep and as far as you want to go in the rubber band." End quote.
Yeah, you might want to pick another analogy or...
What?
Yeah.
Do you know what? Is that some phrase? Do you know what that means?
No, that is not an entertainment phrase. Okay, that is
not a tech phrase. Okay, I'm like, the rubber band?
Yeah, I don't even think it's... I think that's a phrase, I guess, you make fun of because that's what we're doing. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess I thought maybe you'd say, no, Michael, that's common phrase in tech. But apparently it's not.
No. Sarah Bareilles, the pop star behind the hit Broadway musical Waitress, is taking over the lead role at the end of March. The current lead is Jesse Mueller, one of the biggest new draws on Broadway in recent years. But Bareilles has a huge fan base and is sure to prove a potent draw during the 10 weeks she'll be in the spotlight. Indeed, the box office racked up $1.2 million in sales the day it was announced. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. You know, when Jesse Mueller steps out, she's a big draw. So it's important to have somebody there. This show has great word of mouth. Women like it. I think it might have recapitalized by now. It's one of three shows so far to recapitalize from last season. You know, the way they handled this was a little silly. People are like, there are rumors. They're like, no, that's a crazy suggestion that she would go in. Maybe she would do like one if Jesse were sick. All right. Okay, she was thinking of maybe doing it for a weekend just to try. Okay, she's stepping in for 10 weeks. It's like, just, you know, say nothing and then tell us. Don't deny it when you, you know, when there's some truth to it.
Now, I'd like to thank Raul Barril for helping point this out to us, although I guess we did see it. It was everywhere, basically, this next story. It's about PewDiePie. YouTube star PewDiePie, a.k.a. Felix Kjellberg, has been dumped by Disney's Maker Studio for instigating anti-Semitic videos and then defending them as humor. In one, PewDiePie used the service Fiverr to pay two guys in India to hold up a sign that said, "Death to all Jews." Hilarious! Yeah. Actually, it's not. It's not hilarious at all. PewDiePie says the point he was making was how crazy it was that people will do anything for $5. He also posted 9 other videos with anti-Semitic elements and Nazi imagery. He later apologized and said, "Though this was not my intention, I understand that these jokes were ultimately offensive." He also insisted they be seen as entertainment, not commentary, though he explicitly defended them as being a commentary about the internet, not for their humor. Later, he said on Tumblr, you know, that's that place where you get all of your hard-hitting news, "I think it's important to say something, and I want to make one thing clear. I am in no way supporting any kind of hateful attitudes." PewDiePie has amassed almost 15 billion video views on his main YouTube channel alone, but for how long? Now YouTube has cut ties with him as well, canceling a reality series and removing his channel from its premium tier service. He has 53 million subscribers. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, I think, maybe. You know, they removed him from their premium tier service. They didn't ban him from YouTube. Not that I think they necessarily should have, because YouTube is so big. I think that it's very rare that you should decide to ban somebody from YouTube, you know? You know, it's just, you know, getting kicked off Twitter isn't easy, and getting kicked off YouTube shouldn't be either, however hateful you think whatever he said and did was. But he wins, right? Because you had to say PewDiePie like 10 times.
That's true. And I will say again, Raul Barril sent us this story through Twitter, at Showbiz Sandbox is our handle, and he asked whether it was a big deal or a big whoop, and you said, Michael, it was a big whoop.
I think it's a big deal. It's hard, you know, dealing with every comment that every person makes, whether it's your host of your show, America's Got Talent, saying something in a nightclub that's on Showtime. You know, I think in general, you want to just, are people angry and upset? Is it something you need to worry about? Because you don't want to be the thought police. But if it's so far out there, like death to all Jews, that's not a hard one. That's pretty easy. You go, yeah, we don't like that. And they made him pay a price.
Becoming one of the lead theater critics at the New York Times is like getting tenure at a prestigious university. So it was something of a shock when critic Charles Isherwood, second banana to the paper's lead critic Ben Brantley, was abruptly fired. What happened? At first, the rumors included the fact that Brantley and Isherwood simply didn't get along, that Brantley felt Isherwood had bad taste and pushed the paper to find someone else worthy to take over when Brantley retired.
Hello? 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 Got my hand up. Keep going.
Now the New York Post is reporting that after years of clashes between Isherwood and Brantley and editors, top executives combed through Isherwood's emails and decided he was too chummy with Broadway producers Scott Rudin and Robin Goodman. They say emails show Isherwood speaking ill of the paper, as well as Brantley, and complaining openly about how he always got the short end of the stick. So much drama. They should turn it into a Broadway show. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a bad week for the New York Times because they had a review of Big River at the Encores series, which does short weekend runs of shows and sort of a concert production. And that was by Laura Collins Hughes. And if you were hoping to take over for Charles Isherwood, it was a bad week to write a review that was pretty positive about the actual production, but was so confused. And I read it, I was like, what? Like, I mean, I've never seen Big River. I'm like, well, if it's anything like the book, I don't understand what you're saying. It was a very PC, confused review, to the point where the head of Encores, despite the fact that it was basically a positive review, wrote an open letter saying it was stupid. I mean, that is unbelievable that he would go that far. you know, because she could be around there for 20 years. You don't want to piss her, you know. But like, he was like, this is a ridiculous, absurd comment. It is not up to the time standards of the New York Times. So bad week for everybody all around. And so not a good week for her if she wanted to be positioned to get over that. But otherwise, I don't want to comment because, you know, I put it in my resume.
Oh, okay.
So
oh.
There's no way, by the way, that the New York Times, and I don't think this is bad, that they will name me or any other frumpy middle-aged white man as the second critic at the New York Times, because every other theater critic in New York who's at a major outlet is a frumpy middle-aged white man. And if they did pick another frumpy middle-aged white man, people would be like, theater critics so white, New York Times so white. I mean, it would be there should be more diversity covering theater because there's more people writing and creating it. So that means I'm out of a job.
The job you never had.
Hey. Well, I think there will be other people equally as qualified as me, but I do believe I am qualified and should get that job.
Well, let's call them up. On next week's show, we'll call the New York Times and put in our reference for Michael.
I already did.
Now, the thing about these theater critic positions at these big outlets like the New York Times or even the LA Times is that these critics go all over the world. It's not just New York, but they're often in London. They're often in Paris. They'll go to Sydney. They'll review shows everywhere.
Thank you, God.
Yes.
Exactly. I'm ready. I travel cheap. My sister lives in London. I got a free place to stay. You don't have to buy a hotel room. I got family in Toronto. I got you in LA. They don't have to buy a hotel room. I'll sleep in my car.
Okay, well, let's move on to author Philip Pullman, who created one of the most acclaimed works of fantasy in recent years, dubbed his Dark Materials. It received remarkable reviews, sales nearing 20 million worldwide, and spun off everything from a bad movie, to a good radio play, to a brilliant stage version, to a TV series now in development. All this for a work that challenged religious authority, featured gay angels, the death of God, and a monolithic church as the villain in a series nominally geared towards children. Wow, so G-rated then. But Pullman isn't done with the world he created. The outspoken author says a new trilogy dubbed The Book of Dust takes place roughly around the same time as the earlier books, is neither a sequel nor a prequel, but sort of equal. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Just say it's a companion piece.
Yeah.
I don't know why he decided to come up with a new word. I think it's a big deal. I love the books. I'm excited by him. He's a terrific author. I've interviewed him twice, at least two times, maybe three times. Went to his home in Oxford before he had to move because so many people swarmed there because that was where he wrote his Dark Materials. My problem is that he's done a lot of different work in the past, and I feel like a lot of fantasy authors, he's become trapped in the world he created. It's really, really hard to let go. You devote a lot of years to creating some specific world or alternate reality. You people it with characters and a history and things. And this is hard to move on. And he's clearly been trapped in this world and can't let go. And now he's done something new. I hope it's really good. I hope it's just as worthy. I also wish 10 years ago he'd been able to write something else.
One tricky part of being a multinational corporation is dealing with all those damn countries. China pushes you to not share facts about that country with its people. India may be offended by watching a married couple kiss. And the name of your TV show turns out to be a dirty word when translated into Portuguese. Anyway, it ain't easy, especially when it comes to politics. CNN and a number of channels have run afoul of the government in Venezuela, not the U.S., although given what happened last week in this country, you know, it could have been the U.S. Venezuela has become practically a failed state, and the government has cracked down on numerous TV stations for pointing this fact out. We'll probably be blocked now, by the way, in Venezuela.
What does Showbiz Sandbox say? What does that translate into in Spanish?
I think, I don't know, actually.
Keep going.
When CNN found itself booted off the air, they discovered another way of bringing the news to Venezuelans. YouTube. The channel live streams on YouTube as well as its own site, though CNN's site can be more easily blocked. Other stations are discovering similar workarounds to still be viewed in contentious territories. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. It's just a government that's not functioning properly, so you shouldn't be surprised when a dictatorial or failed state or a totalitarian state like China or Saudi Arabia or Venezuela is behaving that way. However, it's not quite related, but I was interested what your thoughts about the Geneva Convention for the Digital Space that Microsoft proposed. They said, you know what? The digital realm is too important. We need to come up with rules for the world so that we are not all fighting country by country. We need to all agree on certain standards of what we will and will not do. Is this a thing that needs to happen? Will it happen? Is it going to work?
I think, yes, it probably is something that's worth investigating. I think it's going to be very difficult to pull off.
Because the countries just won't want to agree? And well, there's no way to penalize them and say, all right, China, if you don't like it,
Geneva Convention itself, it still needs to be enforced and you need to know when it's being broken. So, and it's
I think that's the whole point, right? To set up rules and then you can start punishing people when they break them. Like if you want to be a member of the World Trade Organization.
Right. Although, as you can see, based on some of the recent actions by countries in the World Trade Organization, they don't always get punished for breaking them. And they're, you have to find out that they're breaking them. The same thing with the Geneva Convention. Here in the digital world and in the digital realm, it's going to be even harder to find out whether certain rules are being broken.
Well, that was CNN, and some things are hard to hide, such as Fox News. We all know that they dumped Roger Ailes. The reason may be complicated, but we know part of it was that he was being sued for sexual harassment, and the company was being sued for sexual harassment by Ailes and others at Fox News. They settled a number of those lawsuits, and they forgot to tell their shareholders, which apparently is a no-no. And now the SEC is investigating Fox News. Subpoenas have been served to determine whether they broke the law.
Yeah, I mean, so here, what the issue is kind of I don't want to say a formality because it's not, but
it's not a formality. It's like you have to let your investors know if you're forking out tens of millions of dollars for certain reasons. You can't just hide it.
Right. Well, and the issue becomes whether the money that they paid was significant enough to change the returns for the quarters or years in which they were paid out. That's the issue. Oh, and if they're not,
I thought there was usually a level of price.
No, I mean, well, yes, it depends on how much money.
If it's over seven figures, you should let them know.
Well, you don't necessarily have to if you're making, 20 figures, let's say, then it's like, it's like half of 1% of 1%. So why would we,
Because it's not a cost of doing business, but a vulnerability that could lead to bigger lawsuits and bigger problems in the future. If you're constantly having to pay people out for the workplace, that may indicate a bigger problem.
Yes, that's a forward-looking statement. And yes, they should probably say, hey, we've had a number of lawsuits and that could lead to the erosion of our brand.
Yeah.
That they could say. They don't necessarily have to highlight how much money they're paying if it is not financially significant. What the SEC is trying to find out is whether it was financially significant. In other words, did your profits decrease because you had to pay all of this money out, or was it, were you able to kind of...
Well, they decreased by $10 million or whatever the number was.
$40 million to Roger Ailes. So, but the question is, was it $40 million over, in one lump sum or over a number of years? And yeah, I mean, it gets quite technical.
It doesn't need to.
Yeah,
they should have told them.
Well, I think now, speaking of television, TV's number one sitcom in total viewers and the 18 to 49 demographic isn't going anywhere. News leaked that CBS plans to renew Big Bang Theory for two more seasons, with the five original stars receiving $1 million an episode. The show is rather long in the tooth, which may explain why it wasn't renewed for three seasons, as it has been twice before. Yet again, we see that multi-season renewals are the new black. As of now, there's no indication they plan to make the 12th season the show's last. Maybe they should have. Last week, it scored its lowest overnight rating since 2008 and almost hit a series low. So basically, it scored its lowest overnight ratings since before Barack Obama was president. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal.
Yes.
Renewing for two seasons is now the new renew for one season. But I also think, they're really getting declining returns on this show. It's time to put even people I know who watch it and used to like it, which I never did, are like, it's getting a little tired. I mean, of course it is. It's 12 seasons, for God's sake. So they really should have at least said these are the last two, or they better decide next year to make that last year the final one, because then they can juice more out of it. Because if they just, drag it out, it's already getting hurting. That's not a good sign. The lowest ratings in a decade. You know what? The gravy train is over. Make it a grand finale so you don't start to damage the brand. Not that they would, I guess.
Well, as a follow-up to last week, LA's most prominent and busiest casting workshop has closed its doors in the wake of charges filed by the district attorney here in Los Angeles. The Actors Key has gone out of business and declared bankruptcy. So the actors who prepaid for some classes will be, what's the technical word that I'm looking for? Screwed, actually. They will be screwed over one last time, since the likelihood of getting all their money back is slim to none, and slim just walked out the door. California has been cracking down on the so-called pay-to-audition workshops preying on aspiring actors with the dreams of making it, who imagine these workshops will give them access to powerful casting people. Is New York next? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal because they're finally cracking down on an abusive system. And, you know, it's what a shocker that, you know, you're chugging along, but when there's a lawsuit filed, suddenly you're bankrupt.
Yeah, pretty much.
They want to run with the money that they have. If there's a better example of the fact that you are a crook and ripping people off, that's it.
Now, speaking of ripping people off, I love what our subject is for Inside Baseball this week. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, okay, they are here in the United States, but as you'll see, they kind of hold sway in international bodies. They have a huge impact on major media companies, tech companies, and thus the U.S. and the world, as I just mentioned. Under President Trump, the FCC has quickly moved to undermine any push by the government to maintain what is referred to as net neutrality. If companies want to favor their own services over those of competitors, who is the FCC to complain? That will mean less competition, fewer new innovators, and eventually higher prices for consumers. Now the FCC has moved on to high-speed internet, the backbone of a modern country these days. FCC Commissioner Mike O'Reilly has consistently voted against raising the standards of what constitutes high-speed broadband service. Now he's publicly scoffed at the idea of high-speed internet as some sort of necessity, calling it a novelty, and 4K streaming video as many, many years away from availability. The U.S. already has some of the slowest speeds and highest costs in developed countries around the world. Now it appears they may fall even further behind.
I love this because I put this story in and you're like, ah, we covered that last week. Net neutrality. I go, this guy says 4K is like a decade away. And you're like, what?
Yeah.
He's got your dander up. You're like, that will not stand.
Yeah. I was like, I wanted to kill this story.
This is what he said. This is what is so annoying. He's commenting at the FCC about raising the standard of what constitutes broadband, which is the only way to make companies provide better service under our current system. To justify setting the new benchmark at 25/3, as opposed to the current 4/1 or even 10/1, as several commentators suggested, the report notes that 4K TV requires 25 millibits per second.
Megabits per second.
Megabits per second. So 4K TV requires 25 megabits per second. But 4K TV is still relatively new and is not expected to be widely adopted for years to come. While the statute directs us to look at, quote, advanced telecommunications capability, this stretches the concept to an untenable extreme. Some people, for example, believe, probably incorrectly, that we are on the path to interplanetary teleportation. Should we include the estimated bandwidth for that as well? End quote. I mean, what an idiot.
this is a guy, and you know, Michael, I always play Switzerland. I always try to stay in the middle. You know that. I try and see both sides of the story. I don't know what I'm missing here, because frankly, I read a statement like that, okay? And this is a guy that was put in place by a Democratic president. I do not know if this person should be a commissioner, because I have no idea how they could be so wrong. Now, let's just take some of the technicality out of this. What they're referring to is 25/3, 4/1, and even 10/1. They're referring to megabytes up, not megabytes, megabits up versus megabits down. So they're saying you could have 4 megabits per second down and 1 megabit per second up. That is considered right now the very base for what high-speed internet is officially. Okay.
That's like the sort of speed that makes you tap your toes and go, dear God, this is taking forever.
Correct. You would basically never, you know, high definition television coming through via cable directly, via coax, okay, is at a minimum 4 megabits per second. Okay. Now, if you're getting it over the air with a big giant antenna, your digital high def signal is usually between 15 and 18 megabits per second coming down. Okay. That's what the signal is. To put that in perspective, the digital cinema spec is compressed at, you know, all content is compressed at 250 megabits per second. Okay, so that's how big those files are. What he's saying here is that 25 megabits per second down and 3 megabits per second up, so when you're uploading something, it would be 25 megabits per second, that is too high. And that 4K...
Like it's nobody needs it.
That nobody needs
saying.
It.
It's absurd.
And what I would say is just go to Best Buy, go to Fry's, go to any consumer electronics sales floor and try and find the non-4K TV these days. You can... You know, right now you can, but next year it might be even harder because I bought a television last year and it was pointless to buy anything but a 4K TV. And I thought to myself while I was buying it, this is stupid that I have to pay for 4K when a couple of things. One, there's no 4K content, okay? There and Blu-ray doesn't do 4K, so everything will have to be upconverted. That was my thinking in February of last year. The reality is Netflix, Amazon, HBO Go, all of these big networks, they do not take content from content owners now unless it is delivered to them in 4K. Why? Because, of course, they're trying to future-proof. They know that in the next 5 years, 4K will be the standard. Having watched HBO Now and HBO Go and Netflix and Amazon, 4K streaming 4K is available, and it is stunning. It is amazing how crystal clear it is. Sometimes a little too crystal clear when you can actually see where the makeup on an actor's face ends. And, you know, like on Westworld, you could really see makeup lines and makeup blotches on some of the main characters. But it's amazing. So for this particular commissioner to say that 4K TV is a decade off, that is wrong.
Well, I think I don't know who he's carrying water for. It's obviously not consumers, and it's obviously not most companies, because most companies, of course, if you have a website, you want net neutrality because you don't want to have to pay to have your website featured and or not upload really slowly anytime someone goes to it. So you should support net neutrality. And if you're in the tech world, I think you want our internet to catch up with the rest of the world, right? In the UK, the average broadband speed is like 23 megabits per second. That's the last year in the UK. I mean, we are way behind Europe. We cost more and we're slower in every category, basically. So I just don't get it. Other than the one or two telco companies that have a monopoly on providing broadband to people's homes and don't want to upgrade their service or face competition, who is he speaking for? He obviously is not dumb. He must know he's wrong. You know, so he's just making nonsense arguments, and it's just annoying.
I don't know whether he is carrying water for maybe the cable operators who know that if broadband doesn't get to you know, above 25 megabit per second down, that, you know, streaming video will never look as good as HD broadcast television or HD, you know, cable television. So therefore, I don't know. But frankly, the fact that you can hardly purchase a TV that isn't 4K means that 4K is here, okay? Now, mind you, I will agree with him.
Well, 3D was here.
Yes.
You couldn't buy a TV that wasn't 3D. It just wasn't something people wanted or used. But he's wrong when he says nobody's going to use 4K. Like you say, it's available on Netflix right now.
Right, and it looks amazing. And once people see it, they're going to say, hey, this is pretty good. Now, frankly, I agree that, you know, not everything is 4K right now. It's slowly getting there. The ability to stream it is slowly getting there. Right now, the question is, should you go gigabit? So that's like, you know, 25 megabit per second. Forget about it. That's like 1,000 megabit per second. So why would you start arguing over 25 megabit per second? It's absurd. And what I would also point out is that competition, at least in the United States, is abysmal. And when Google Fiber, when, you know, Google split themselves up into Alphabet and Google Fiber had to stand on its own as basically its own company, all of a sudden, Google Fiber was, well, maybe we won't be rolling out in all of these cities. All of a sudden, AT&T, Verizon, all of these competitors like Comcast said, oh, well, maybe we won't roll out fiber either. So
yeah.
That hurts consumers. And if you look
at businesses
and if you look at what happens in Europe where there is competition and in South Korea where there is competition, I mean, the speeds are phenomenal. Same thing in Scandinavia. Competition breeds a better result.
Yeah. And let's not get caught up in 4K. The general comment that high speed broadband internet is a novelty that most people don't need is just ridiculous.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Well, we have a link in our show notes. You can email a letter to Michael Reilly, because you should, if you have a business and you use the internet or you have a website, you care about net neutrality and you care about high-speed broadband internet. And unless you're one of those two or three telcos, you're going to be punished if his attitude goes forward. So we got a link in our show notes if you want to send him an email, and you can read the one I sent to him myself.
Well, that wraps up Inside Baseball for this week. Moves us along into our obituary section. We just want to kind of mention this briefly. Richard Schickel, the film critic for Time magazine, died at the age of 84 over the weekend.
That's right. I mean, at one point, there were the two Dicks.
I always thought of
Richard Schickel and
show.
Richard Corliss.
That's right. Richard Schickel and Richard Corliss.
I could never keep them straight. I was a kid, you know. That was in the era when the Time magazine was reaching like 10, 20 million people around the world. I mean, there's a lot of people reading. And there's still a couple million people who get Time magazine. It's still a big magazine. But it was really dominated the era. So being one of their two critics really had a lot of weight to it. I don't have a very vivid impression of Richard Schickel and his taste, but I know he, you know, did a lot of documentary films, wrote some books, partnered with some of the artists that he covered over the years and did books with them or about them, and, you know, spoke up for the critic and how it's not just something that people should, you know, it's a job and a career and need to be informed and intelligent and know film history and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, on the better side of the angels.
Correct. Yeah. And now Richard Schickel and Richard Corliss, you're not the only person that had trouble kind of remembering, wait, which one was that, the one that came before or after?
They were there at the same time for a number of years.
Yeah. And of course, Richard Corliss passed away in 2015. Now Richard Schickel has passed away at the age of 84.
And our show has passed away none too soon.
Oh, my God. Really? Seriously? Our own show? Well, okay.
Our episode, at least.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Yes, this episode is long in the tooth, as you say. That said, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, the Google Play Store, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can find our show. And please do rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. You can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. That information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. That's where you'll find all those ways to subscribe to us or ways to follow us. At showbizsandbox is our Twitter handle, or you can search for us on Facebook. Just look up Showbiz Sandbox. You can find information on how to contact us there at our website as well, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group, MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
High-speed broadband, bring it to the heartland.com.
And if that whole domain is too big to remember and type in, why not just go to the Huffington Post to read some of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry, or just visit michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to look at bookfilter.com for some of his latest book picks. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice. Under an hour and 30 minutes. Yes.
That's not under. That's not under. That's over an hour. That's not under 4 hours. Oh, such an accomplishment.